Okay, I'll get started. The stuff on. Yeah. So I'm going to assume all of you who are here have submitted the homework. If anybody is missing, just put it over there. I'm going to continue talking about these two process critical section problems. I'll tell you in a minute why. But before that, let me spend a few minutes talking about a project that I posted. Now, it's about it's a simple thing. It's about building queues. Queues are something you do in your introductory programming classes or 210 or whatever it is. I mean, you probably have written programs using queues, or you should have written programs using queues. So that's a queue. And a little more detail. Queues have a head and a tail. And the reason I want you to write a queue is because we'll be doing scheduling and a few other things, and we'll need queues. We'll need many queues, too many queues. So we want to write some routines that can handle many queues. And I want you to write, and there are lots of different ways of doing queues. The only real people only use doubly linked queues. Anything else is just a waste of time. So that means there's a next pointer. So this is a structure. And there is a previous pointer. And I'll call them N and P. And it looks like that. That diagram's not complete. What else should there be? No, probably complete depending upon. But let's say I want doubly linked. Circular. And let me explain. There's something called a doubly linked circular queue. That's the most general form of a queue. That's the one that's nice to use. A little bit difficult to implement, but once you've done it, pretty cool. What else should I do here to adhere to that requirement? Uh-huh. Yeah, the tail and the head. So this is the tail, that's the head. This next pointer here should be pointing to this guy. The previous pointer here should be pointing to this guy. And there is only one pointer pointing to the queue head, whatever you want to call it, pointing to this. This is the first element in the queue. There is no dummy element. There are ways of doing queues where the first element is not an element but a dummy element. I just chose both are correct. For this program, I specified that don't put a dummy element. Just because. Okay? It can be done with a dummy element. So no dummy element. Queue header points to the first element. If there is no elements in the queue, empty queue, that should be possible, in which case the header pointer is null. And that's all you need. From the header, you can find the tail, you can find the next, you can do everything. And there's a set of routines defined that manipulates this queue. And so there might be lots of other header pointers pointing to different queues. So we'll have multiple queues. And that's about it. Oh, I forgot the payload. What you are putting in the queue is a payload. That is, this is the real item, the red part. The next and the previous are bookkeeping links to make sure that this thing is structured. The payload is what you're putting in the queue. So if I'm putting PCBs in the queue, these would be PCBs. So for testing purposes, I said just use an integer. You can use two integers if you want to, but at least one integer over there to test the queue. Now, it's stated in the assignment, and I'm going to restate it over and over again, that it's very common to make mistakes in the queue, and these mistakes are subtle, and very strange things happen later. Okay? Later, when we are going to use these queues to do some scheduling or whatever, bad things will happen. One of the simplest bad things is that it crashes with a segmentation violation. That's actually good. You just immediately catch the problem, you trace it back, you fix it. But no, very strange things happen. Programs start executing in places that it shouldn't be. Pretty bizarre stuff happens. Anything strange happening to your program almost always means your queue implementation is not correct. That's how it has worked out over the years in this project. That any mistake made in the queue elements, queue implementation will show up much later with bizarre behavior, and you'll spend a lot of time trying to debug that program. No, it's not that program misbehaving, it's the queue misbehaving. So please make sure it's correct, test it. That's the project one. Any questions? Okay. So I did cover, with some detail, the two-process software solution to the critical section problem, and I was going to move on. And I decided to go back and do it again, because this is the starting point where you should start thinking about programs, not as sequential programs, but as programs that execute multiple threads, and they have much more complex behaviors than any single-threaded programs you have written so far. So it's trying to learn a new skill which cannot really be taught. You have to get it. So it'll take you time. And so all I can do is give examples and talk about why things work or why things don't work, but you've got to take it from there. So starting all over again, we have two processes or threads. They're executing in a loop. Most of the time they do stuff that is not related to the critical section. We'll call it the remainder section. And there is another one of these which has a remainder section. Somewhere here there is a critical section. We'll call it CS. And before the critical section, we have entry code and we have exit code. And I want to write identical, almost identical, very symmetric entry codes for these two processes, such that they're independent. So they just run at any speed they want to, or the scheduler lets them. We have no control over the speed of these things. Adding delays and all that means nothing. it automatically certain delays will get added by the scheduler, so you have no control over speed. But if they come racing through at the same time or at different times, all we want is not more than one process, so we only have two. Either this one or that one can be executing inside the critical section. No one executing inside the critical section is fine. But at most one process can be executing inside the critical section at one point in time, which means we have to have the mutex property. Short for mutual exclusion. The statement that only one process, at most one process, can execute in the critical section at a time is called the mutex property, mutual exclusion property. That is, the process that is executing is excluding the other ones, and they mutually exclude each other when they execute there. It also must... It also must satisfy the properties of progress and bounded waiting. All three conditions must be true. Okay? Any questions on this setup? And then I showed you the code for this, which we will do again. So the font's a little bad, but these are the two processes that I hand wrote last time. I'm including the printed one here. The I and J is a little, so I and J stands for 0 and 1. This process 0, I is 0, J is 1. And the only difference between these two, the code, is I and J are flipped here. Everything else is identical. So I is replaced by J over here, J is replaced by I over here. Okay, so we started arguing that this will work, and the proper labels should be that this is the entry section. So this piece of code doesn't show the loop, but it has the entry section, the critical section, and the exit section. And this, these things will run in loops. Flag is a two-element array, and it's set to false initially, false, false. And turn initially is set to, doesn't matter, I or J, let's say I. It's not really relevant. Now, what do we do with this? How do we even talk about this? Well, we can start with some simple things like this process, J, is not executing. It's in the remainder section and it's stuck there. Can process I use the critical section multiple times. Will this code allow that? Anybody want to say yes, yes. No, how? How?
Flag I
gets false here, by the way.
It changes it to true.
It changes it to true.
And whenever it's going through the while loop, it'll never stop there because it never...
Because it's checking flag J. Will flag J be true or false?
False.
Okay. So this is in the remainder section, so flag J will be false. If flag J is false, whatever the value of turn is not relevant. Right? Because one falsity in a while loop will make the whole, in an AND condition, will make the whole thing false. So it will drop out of the while loop. Then it will go into the critical section. It will going to exit, set flag to false. It will come back around, set flag I to true. J is still false, so it can continue. Okay? So multiple entry into the critical section works as long as this guy is not. How about if process J is in the critical section? Then what happens? And process I attempts to enter. It won't be able to. Go over the details.
Flag J turns true.
When it's in the critical section, flag J is true. I can say that because flag J is a variable not touched by anybody other than J. That fellow has no flag J in there, or changing of flag J. So once flag J is between over there and over here, flag J will always be true. So if it's in here, flag J is true. Now this guy comes around. What does it do? This one's in the critical section. That's why flag J is true. It'll get stuck in the while loop. Okay, I'll go further than that. So flag I will be set to true, turn will be equal to J. While flag J, this is true. This being true does not make the whole thing true. This has to be true. So we want both of these to be true. If both of these are true, it'll get stuck in the while loop. Because it's an infinite loop. There's nothing there. So is this true? Why? Because PI set turn to J. And this guy's in the critical section, it's not changing anything. So J was set there. Turn can be set in two places. That's a little nifty. But if it's already in the critical section, it will not set it, so it gets stuck here. Okay. This guy goes out. Will we be able to come in? Why? Flag J. Good. Flag J becomes false. This one, next time it checks, this whole condition will be false. The while loop is done. We'll get out. How about this process is checked this, found it's true, came around to check it again. It's a busy loop, so it'll check it over and over again. Came around to check it again, and the scheduler put it to sleep. That is, it's pausing there. It's very slow. Now, this process goes out. He's not going to get in because he hasn't checked. He hasn't even attempted. Things can run very slow. Sometimes we can say, like, what if the extreme case? It's going to sit in there for a long time before checking. He goes out. That fellow is not in its critical section. Can you go back in? If he could, then he could do it again also, and that would violate bounded waiting. Bounded waiting means if I'm waiting to get in, the other person shouldn't sneak around and jump its turn. So how do you make sure that this guy, that guy is kind of not executing its while, it's right there, this guy keeps doing this. No, I'm not changing anything. Okay. This is a sacred algorithm. I'm not going to mess with it. This is correct. I just need an explanation of why what I said really doesn't happen.
So if the process J comes around again, it'll
change turn to I. Okay, process I is in the while loop and it's not doing anything really. It has set flag I is true. It has set turn to J. But this guy will set turn to I. Set flag J to true. And then when it checks flag I is true, turn is equal to I. So it waits. So this is not getting past this while loop. But since it's waiting and that guy is this guy could be spinning, this guy is not spinning and waiting. Now what's going to happen? Now flag J has become true now. We said this can go in because flag J is false when it left. But it came back and set flag J to true. So is it possible that both of them will be stuck in their while loops? Because turn, what happened to turn? Turn is I. This is false. Next time it checks, however slow it is, eventually it will check. When it checks, it will find flag J is true, but turn is equal to I. So this part is false. It can enter the critical section. I kind of insinuated that bounded waiting is satisfied, but I didn't even show really that is mutual exclusion satisfied. If somebody is in there, the other person can't come in. That is fine. But is there a situation where both can get in? Because the execution of this entry section happens in little by little and unpredictably fast or slow. So if we do a lockstep, flag I to true and flag J to true are just simple store instructions. They just set the two memory locations. That would be atomic. That is, it happens in a cycle. Turn equals to J, so they both set flag I, flag J at the same time. They both set turn is equal to J and turn is equal to I at the same time, let's say. And then, exactly at the same time, they both check the while condition. Now what?
So which one of them had to set turn last?
One of them had to set turn last. That is very important. If it's one single CPU, single cycle, then something has to happen before something. If it's two completely separate cores on a computer where it can happen simultaneously, let's not plug this in right. Anyway. Something strange happened. I went to sleep. then the two cores will write I and J into the same element of memory simultaneously. The way computer hardware is designed, multicores are designed, if there are two writes to the same point in memory, the memory will make it sequential. So it'll either be I or be J. It cannot be both, right? So it's either I or J. So if both are in the while loop, turn is either I or J. And depending upon whether it's I or if it's I, this guy gets to go in. If it's J, this guy gets to go in. And the other guy gets stuck. So if they race them, if they race in exactly at the same speed, then it's unknown who gets in, but only one of them will win. Whoever writes to turn the last will win. You may say that's not fair, but fairness is not in the list of things. Mutual exclusion, progress, bounded waiting. Mutual exclusion is met. If one is in, the other one can't get in. If they come in at the same time, I can't think of an execution where both will get in. Because if both got in, then turn has to be I and J approximately at the same time. Notice the carefulness of this. This guy flips turn to let that guy in. That guy flips turn to let this guy in. So whoever comes first will get stuck if the other flag is set. That is a subtle thing in this algorithm that makes it work, and it took like 40 years for somebody to figure this out. So this is a pretty dangerous code. Any change you make to this, it's not going to work. This one works. Progress. Can they get stuck? Or can they alternate? Can they get stuck in the while loops forever? And the answer is no, because turn is either I or J. Yeah.
Did you do this with three processes going at the same time?
No, you can't do it. I mean, I'm not saying you cannot do it with three processes, but if you put I, J, and K, it's not going to work. So progress is met. Progress also says it shouldn't be taking turns. One should be able to come in if the other one's not interested. That happens. That's what we showed first. So yeah, it's easy to say, okay, this is a well-known algorithm, it works. That's not the point. How does it work? Why does it work? Can you really see that it works? Because that's going to help you understand these sort of programs. What other execution can I think of? Okay, how about process J comes and kind of slows down here, sets flag to true, has not set turn yet. So process J comes up to that squiggly blue line. Process I tries to enter. Will it be able to? This guy's slow. No. Tell me why not.
Flag J will be true and turn will be J.
Flag J will be true, turn will be J, so process I will get stuck. So now what happens?
So
We have to wait for the CPUs to, we have to wait for this guy to move. Will this guy be able to get in?
Yeah.
Yes. So as long as this guy doesn't get in, he's not going in. Is that a problem? According to our definitions, no. They're both trying to get in. This guy did not get stuck anywhere. It's the scheduler or whatever playing games with this guy. It is guaranteed to eventually run. The scheduler only makes guarantees saying, if you're running, if you're in the ready queue, you will eventually run. Doesn't say when. So eventually it's going to get in. That's good enough for me, who says one of them needs, if two wants to get in, one of them should be able to get in and not get stuck indefinitely. Okay, it'll not get stuck indefinitely at that blue line. It might get stuck for some time. What if it got stuck after turn is equal to I? And then process I tried to get in. So we move the blue and drew a red line here. It got stuck here.
I will go through.
Yes, no? Yes. Because I will set turn is equal to J. What? No, I will get stuck. In the previous case, in the blue case, I goes through. In the red case, I get stuck. Right? Because I sets turn is equal to J. Both flags are true. Turn is equal to J is true. Flag J is true. So I get stuck. And whenever this one moves, this one moves. Anything else you can think of? Yeah.
So in the blue case, I would get stuck and then it would go to J and then I would go after turn is set to I. Is that how it goes?
Yes. Thank you. If it's at blue, I will not be able to get in. So it'll get stuck and it's flipping around. Eventually this will set turn is equal to I and it will get stuck too. So both of them get stuck. This one's spinning. No, that's not true. Next time this one spins, it's going to go through. Because turn is I. In the blue case, turn I gets set later. So getting to know all the possibilities is the hard part. It's a three-line program. How hard can a three-line program be? It is. Because it's not a sequential program. There's no complicated expressions, there's nothing. It's very, very simple programming. There's just a condition and two assignment statements. But there are so many different ways it can execute. The richness is not in the code, but in the execution patterns. So I did say it's a two-process solution. We're doing it with two processes. I said it's a software solution. That's actually an important thing. Software solution means I'm using just software, just standard programming language, base level programming language. I'm not using any privileged opcodes, any special codes that a CPU has implemented for multitasking or something. Nothing. Plain vanilla programming. So for a long time it was thought that with plain vanilla programming you cannot solve this problem. You need some sort of special shiny stuff. But that's not true. This is the Decker showed it first, but this is the simplest one. But yeah, with vanilla programming it can be done. Okay, questions? If you don't understand it, you might as well ask now. Because things will go...
Process I sets up a wag for I?
Process I sets up a?
Wag for I. It sets up, sets by I to true, that means, and sets the turn to J, J to run.
This is the code. What happened? There are two ways. One is you can interpret turn is equal to J means J should run.
Yeah.
That's an interpretation. Yes, that's mostly true, but not always true. Because turn is equal to J is a statement that only sets the value 1 into the variable turn. What is its effect? Its effect is multifold depending upon whether this guy overwrites it or not. And if this guy doesn't overwrite turn, then this guy is going to get blocked because turn is J. But if that turn gets overwritten, then it gets blocked here. But the turn becomes completely irrelevant if the flag is false. Okay? So we've got to look at exactly what the effect of these statements are rather than go like, okay, turn is equal to J means that guy's turn. Yes, in some cases it is. But not always. I mean, I could have renamed term to foo and I and J to something else. It still would work. Yeah.
So the first statement setting the flag would be just a request to get into the critical section.
That's how it's being interpreted in English. But reality says, first statement is there is an assignment of a value into this slot. And I'm calling it flag because I want to relate it to something from a flag. But if I renamed any of this, suddenly your English interpretation will change, but the program will work the same. So you're trying to figure out what does this program do. So yeah, this flag is like, I'm reserving my spot. Don't you go nowhere. However, you can be ignored because there's a turn. And setting the turn means I'm giving you a chance to go in. But that's also not always true. I can be able to get in. So it's more of the correctness of the code than what these things mean. The meaning changes here. So deaf and blind drivers putting rocks in a bowl is pretty much this. What does the rock mean? Depends on how you're using it. It's deaf and blind because these processes just run. They don't stop for anything. They don't see. Process J cannot see process I, but can see some trails left by process I. It can check flag I. And it doesn't know flag I is set by process I, that the programmer wrote it as flag I is set by process I. Okay? Shall I move on? Okay. What if we have more than two processes? Of course we would have more than two processes in any system. Not going to spend too much time on this, although it's a lot more complex. There's an algorithm called the Lamport-Bakery algorithm. I'll quickly cover the Lamport-Bakery algorithm. I've been trying to follow the textbook, but the Lamport-Bakery algorithm's not in the textbook. I like it because it was in the textbook. The dumbed-down version doesn't have it. So as we are progressing, we are taking out material that your ancestors learned. So Lamport-Bakery algorithm is in the Wikipedia page. It's named after Lamport, who has a long list of stuff he has done, including LaTeX, which is the text processor you guys are supposed to use, the formatting system. That's Leslie Lamport. But distributed systems, concurrent systems, he's kind of the god. So Lamport-Bakery algorithm works like this. Doesn't fit. Okay, I crossed out two lines to make my life simpler, but those two lines are necessary. But it's easy to explain this algorithm. It's quite easy to prove that the algorithm works even after deleting those two lines, which is not true. Okay. This says, so there used to be this system where you tore off little slips of paper when you entered the bakery or some place, and they call out your number and you go in according to your number. This is an algorithm that uses that method. This is an algorithm where multiple processes trying to get in, there is no gatekeeper. The processes themselves have to decide who gets in, and only one process goes into the critical section at one point in time. Okay, just like the two processes. There's no third process coordinating their behavior. They individually decide who gets to go in. In this case, I can delete that choosing also over here. So I'm deleting all references to choosing. So there's an array called num, which is all zero. And it has n entries, where n is the number of processes. And this is this algorithm is the entry section for process I. So process I picks a number. Process I picks a number which is the maximum of all the numbers from 0 through n minus 1. So picks the scans this array, picks the highest number, adds 1 to it, assigns it back to its own slot, which is num I. So let's say I is this process. So the number picked here is your ticket to go in. And then process I does one for loop only once, scanning for any number that might be lower than its number, ignoring zeros, because zeros means they're not interested. So for I's For J is this pointer going around. It goes from 0 to n minus 1, and it checks num J. If it's 0, there's a while loop here. If it's 0, this is false, so it goes back to the next for loop. If num J is not 0, and num J is less than num I, then it gets stuck in this loop. Ignore this. There's a J and a I here. I'll explain that. But assume this is num J and this is num I. So it's going to scan this. It's going to scan and find a number less than its number star. And it's going to get stuck there until that number becomes 0, because it's going to assume that guy might be 1 in the critical section, or it should go in before me. It'll come to itself. Since this is not less, it'll skip over itself and try to see if there's anybody. If there is nobody on one scan, it just goes in. Sounds like that should work for an n-process solution. Except it's not so simple, obviously. It works. But there is more nuances here. First thing is to notice that, can two processes have the same number? Pick the same number? Process number 3 and process number 5, can they pick the same number as their ticket? Yes, no. In both cases, why? Yeah. They cannot?
Yeah.
Why do you say they cannot?
Well,
if you're in a bakery and are we in a bakery here? I mean, we are going by this writing on the wall. What about this code? Yeah.
Technically, they could just choose the same index.
No. The indexes are fixed, like IJ in the previous one. So there are n processes. Somebody decided you are 0, you are 1, you are 2, you are 3. So I'm 3. I come in, I look at the scan this array, pick the maximum, add 1, and I got 7, and I put it here. Somebody else who's number 6 looked at it, picked a number. Can that person pick the same number? I'm not saying is there a rule disallowing that? Will this code allow such a thing?
No.
No?
Because of the assignment statement, so it won't be paused anywhere halfway through the process.
Why not?
Or even if it is, if it hasn't assigned the number yet, then another process could assign its number.
Correct.
It will find that. And
no, it may not. It's scanning the array. It's finding the maximum. It's not rescanning 2 million times. So it could have, in fact, scanned the entire array, found the maximum, added 1 to it, and then it got a little slow and didn't assign the number. So its number is still 0. So I scanned the array and I decided the highest number in there is 5, so I'm going to assign 6 to my ticket slot, and I haven't assigned it yet. Somebody else goes in, scans the entire array, finds, what did I say, 6? Or whatever, finds the same number, as takes 1, puts it in. Now, I will not rescan the array, so we'll both have the same number. This could have been avoided if I had a critical section around this number choosing part. Do it one by one, you will never get the same number. I can't do that because I'm trying to implement critical sections. I don't have it yet. So when you're building a critical section, you can't use a critical section. Critical sections are very useful things, but building them are a problem. So yeah, two people can have the same number. Will one number be less? Two people can pick two different numbers, then obviously one number will be less than the other number. Then when they come and do this game, there's a problem about those two numbers being equal. Both of them will skip over each other, or that's not less, and move on. And both will get in. So to fix that problem, there's a tiebreaker here. The notation means that we just look at the two numbers, really. Which is numj less than numi? If it is, then this is true. However, if numj and numi are exactly the same, then this I and j will tie break. Is j less than I? So this two will never be equal. Okay? They just cannot be equal because of the construction. So if two people pick the same number, it still works. And the important thing to see, which is kind of difficult to see, is that this one scan over there and one scan over here, happening at any speed you want, not happening at one shot, still the algorithm works. If you want to understand this, you'll have to spend, I don't know, at least an hour over it, which is very strongly recommended. You'll understand the skill of having n processes doing n different things and competing for entry into the critical section, and it works, and you're going to take my word for it, even though I lied to you, because it doesn't work if you take out those choosing things. It works if I put those green lines back in, otherwise it doesn't work. So quick explanation of why we need the choosing thing. Choosing is just an item like a flag, which is true when somebody is in here, which is false when somebody is in, gets out of the choosing area. And it can happen that somebody else picks the number 4 and has not assigned it yet. Let's go with... Yeah, somebody's picked the number 4 and has not assigned it. So I'll go pick the number 4 and I assign it. And my index is higher than that guy's index. In which case, I will ignore his number 4 when I see it. Or worse, somebody is picking something and is going to pick a lower number. Somebody, and I kind of look at his number. He hasn't assigned it yet. It's 0. So I'm just going to skip it. Okay? So I want to make sure that somebody is in choosing. I do not look at his number if he's choosing. So I block myself here so that I don't come here. So there's a bunch of race conditions here, but it works in spite of race conditions. So I want you to look at how this choosing business works, and I also want you to look at why it is possible that these numbers can go to infinity, even though they're getting set to 0. There's a way that these numbers can overflow and become infinity, which is considered a bad thing for the Lamport Bakery. So it's kind of wrong in the sense it overflows. Okay, I'll take questions. Yeah.
For the typing part, so it first checks to see that the numbers are...
If the numbers are unequal, whichever is greater or lower, that's it. If only if they're equal, then the this thing evaluates to true or false based on ing. Questions?
How does it check they're equal?
That's a program. You can check A3 equal to 4 or not. It's just this code. Oh, maybe this one's a shorthand. You'll have to write this as if number j is not equal to number I, then do check the numbers. If they're equal, then check I and j and then return false or true. So that's more code that's not written down, just shortened. Okay. Yeah.
Is it possible that when you're in that inner while loop, that get interrupted?
Which inner while loop?
The second one.
Yeah.
You get interrupted after you check that num j is not zero.
Yeah. It is possible. Did you check num j is equal to zero? Yeah, you checked num zero is not equal to zero, and you got interrupted. And num j became some number.
Right.
Okay? Possible.
And then, does it still work?
Yes, it'll work. Because whatever num j becomes will be higher than your number. Because he's chosen a higher number because he's looked at your number. And you know that before here, you made sure he wasn't in choosing. Otherwise it could be equal. So he wasn't in choosing. That means he was either before choosing or after choosing. If he's after choosing, num j cannot be zero. It is zero only if it's before choosing. So if he's before choosing, he's going to pick a bigger number. It's carefully done. So yeah, these sort of nuances is what you need to look at. Okay, any more questions? Okay, now for a little bit of philosophy, because I did tell you that these algorithms are not practical. So, Peterson's solution works only for two processes. Lamport's n process, but n process is not good either. It's a fixed n. It's not for any number. You have to fix, this is a constant. So that's no good. Plus, these two have busy waiting. Plus, they're complex. So, actual OS implementers don't want to use this. So why are we even talking about this? We're talking about this because it's a learning experience. Can it be done? How does it work? How do these programs behave? Even if we solve it with some magic wand, the problem does not go away. The problem will raise its ugly head later. So we need to know how these things work in order to go from here. Suddenly I'm going to make things a lot simpler and then it will get a lot more complex. So understanding how Peterson and Lamport works will help you immensely when it gets a lot more complex. That's why this exercise is being done. So, What do we do in real life when we have to program a kernel or threads? Threads, you know, the kernel provides locking stuff and system calls that will take care of it, so life is easy. But I'm writing a kernel. There are no system calls. There's no tools to do anything. I can't use, somebody's invented these algorithms, Lamport, Peterson. I can't use those. They're just too complicated, doesn't work, doesn't fit the needs. So what do we do? So what do we do? The solution to this problem, really, in practical terms, is use hardware. Say, like, look, although we are writing this stuff in software, we need help from the CPU designers to help solve this problem. And maybe they have more power of controlling how the CPUs work in order to fix it. And the simplest hardware solution is to play with interrupts. That is, you go like, I'm going to solve this problem with a rather large hammer. I'm going to disable every interrupt. There's only one CPU in the system. This doesn't work if you have multiple CPUs. If there's only one CPU in the system, I turn off all interrupts into that CPU. Moment I do that, that CPU is going nowhere. It's going to just execute this piece of code. It's not going to get interrupted. It won't jump into an interrupt handler. It cannot get context switch. I've locked it down to execute my code. So by default, I'm in a critical section. There is nothing else that can be happening in the computer. So there's no question about bounded waiting, this, that, because by flipping off the interrupt bit, I get full control of the machine. Got it? But that's not a good solution. That is actually a good solution in the sense that this is the standard solution that is used in all single CPU operating systems. And that's how it's done. But it has some serious downsides. Disabling interrupts is a privileged instruction. You can only do it on the kernel. So if you're doing multi-thread programming, etc., you cannot use this technique. It can only be done in the kernel. Number two, the critical section must be very small. Now, this is a vague statement. How small is very small? I don't know. But we are talking fractions of a millisecond here. Because if you run a CPU with its interrupt disabled in a multitasking environment where it's supposed to do a lot of things and there are peripherals and there are interrupts coming in, you're going to miss a few interrupts. And the moment you miss a few interrupts, it'll lead to a panic. It'll lead to a system crash. You'll freeze the machine. So it's a dangerous thing to do. But it is routinely done in the kernel of single processor operating systems with very good care that the critical section is used for a tiny amount of time. In fact, it is used to leverage the creation of larger critical sections. It is not used for a general purpose critical section getting mechanism. Okay? But you've got to start somewhere. The problem with these critical sections are pretty much you need a critical section to implement a critical section. There's a huge chicken and egg problem. So how do we get the first critical section? You get it by using Lamport or Peterson. No, that's not feasible. Okay, can hardware give me a little critical section and I'm going to leverage it to build critical sections? That's the idea. So this technique gives me a little bit of a critical section where I can breathe easy and say, nothing's going to change. I am the only process or thread running at this point in time. I've locked off everything. Okay? So that's one hardware solution. However, this doesn't work for two processor, or three processor, or four processor systems. I have locked down the interrupts on one processor. The other guys are running. The other guys can enter a critical section when I'm in the critical section, causing disastrous effects, which is violation of mutual exclusion. So it's completely wrong. It's a wrong implementation to use this in a multi-core hardware. Doesn't work. What if you turned off everybody's interrupts? Even if you turned off everybody's interrupts, they will continue to do whatever they were doing. And they could be in a critical section. It just totally does not work. Okay, so we need a slightly better solution to solve the critical section problem in multi-cores. There are three classes of instructions which are hard to implement. Hardware designers have to do this. In multi-core systems, it's actually quite difficult to implement these instructions. They are implemented carefully by CPU designers and tested, and it's important because what these instructions do is read a piece of memory and write something somewhere all in one step without anybody seeing what you're doing. It's called atomic instructions. That is, they happen in one cycle without interference from any other core or any CPU. And that itself, it has to lock the machine essentially, and that's done by electrical signals on the motherboard. And we don't have any set of atomic instructions because, again, they slow down the system. CPU designers don't want to implement them. You're not supposed to use them. However, operating systems kernels are allowed to use an instruction. There's generally one per brand of CPU that is an atomic instruction. Load and store are atomic instructions, always. But they're not good enough. It doesn't do critical sections. You need a much more complex atomic instruction to do it. There are three classes, test and set, compare and swap, and exchange. We, for teaching purposes, we always talk about test and set. That seems to be the academic favorite. Intel implements the exchange. So we'll talk about test and set. Okay? The test and set instruction takes one memory address as an argument and is one opcode. So let's call it TSCT, and we give it a variable x. What will happen is x will be set to 1, so when you execute this, you're guaranteed x, regardless of what the previous value of x was, it'll become 1. So it's like store 1 in x. Okay? But it's got another feature. It'll tell you what the earlier value of x was. So that means there's a load instruction in there. It brings in the earlier value of x, squirrels it away somewhere, writes 1 to x. That's a two-step instruction. Only one-step instructions are atomic. This is a two-step instruction. How does it work atomically? Can it not get interrupted in the middle? No, the hardware designers did it. Can two processors execute it in parallel? No, they cannot. That is enforced by some hardware electrical gimmickry on the motherboard. Okay? That's why it's useful to build critical sections. And it's otherwise, it's a completely useless instruction. We don't need test and set. Its only use is to build critical sections. So how do you build critical sections? From this description, we can rewrite the logic of test and set as so test and set is a function which does three things. Actually, it doesn't do any of this. This is just one opcode. But we software people visualize it as doing these three things done atomically. Okay, so what does that mean? How do we use it? So I put in a while test and set lock instruction, code. That's a proper while statement in software. This is one opcode which takes one argument. And I can put this thing in any number of threads or processes. It's not an end process solution, it's just any number. And what's going to happen is if this process does test and set, it'll get returned the value 0. So it won't get stuck in the while loop. Any process doing test and set will set the value to 1, return 0, go through. However, if two processes does test and set at the same time, one of them will return 0 and the other one will return 1 forever and it'll keep spinning. I will spend a few more minutes on this next class, and then we will build from here. There's a long ways to go. Yeah, anybody have homework? Hang on, just a minute. Which one is that? Lamport?
The one before, I guess. Let me see. The Decker.
Decker?
Yeah.
No, you can skip Decker.
What about the other one? What is it called? The next one?
Peterson.
The Peterson. Yeah.
Don't skip Peterson.
Peterson, is it?
Peterson's the simple one.
Oh, okay. What about the bakery?
Bakery, you know. It is just something that if you know, it will help you.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's a concept, yeah, concept building. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, yeah.
Part one is down. Part two, do you have the sample tools so I can look at?
The answers?
Yes.
I don't know if I have them. I might, might not.
It's just based on something you dumped previously.
Yeah, but did I store the answers? I don't remember.
Well,
no, which one are you talking about? Homework part two. I might be able to tell you the solution.
Yes.
It's actually quite simple.
Yes, quite simple.
Yeah, I trimmed it. I trimmed it.
So I just
while you were giving the lecture,
I had to trim my. That's fine. Have you turned it in? Part
two is totally out of this, right? Yeah, both are like turn it in on paper.
So they have to submit their code on paper.
Yeah.
What?
What is the code?
Oh, they're just like pseudo codes. Okay.
Yeah, it's pseudo code. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. You just need to write whatever that code.
I think it's some transformation stuff and things like that.
Right.
I don't even remember. But yeah. So this is homework.
It has to follow these syntax.
I have my homework in here.
Your homework's here?
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine.
Right, over here.
You have a class to go to.
No. I'm down today. I just came here to.
So when does? Oh, is it Tuesday? You have a class, right?
Tuesday. I have a
okay. Yeah.
But I mean, the recitation of this week is done, and it's been a hell of a lot. I got like an extremely high amount of email requests.
Oh,
yeah, I missed, I was a bit sleepy, so I missed some of the notes. So.
I'm not waiting for you.
No, no.
Yeah, so I'm a bit sleepy, I missed some of the notes.
What did you say?
I missed some of the notes, but
what topic?
Hardware solutions?
Display. Hardware solutions, if you miss something, it'll be on the web in another hour.
Right. All right, so have a nice one.
Okay, see you.
I might have to send you another email requesting for the sample code or whatever solution it is. Is that all right?
Yeah, you have to send me
an email.
Just
give me an email.
Or if I don't have it, the graders will have to work it out anyway.
Yeah, I might talk to the graders.
Disability interrupts?
Disable interrupts, yeah.
Did you write disability or disable?
Disable. Okay, I gotta go. It'll be on the web, so you can look it up.
Let's say do for Tuesday.
Audio.